Welcome to the New Edge Series, an interactive radio program focused on the leading edge of consciousness and its manifestations in the world. Are you sensing that something greater exists? Something bigger, more inclusive, more profound? You are tapping into this powerful collective consciousness that is awakening the world and each of us as we find ways to transform together. Your host, Patricia Albert, is a transformational educator and spiritual visionary who's been focused on the leading edge of consciousness for almost 40 years. She is the founder of the Evolutionary Collective, a new model for awakened community where spiritual realization and actualization are catalyzed through the collective field. Patricia's unusual mastery with group and collective fields of consciousness is a result of working with over 150,000 people. She is currently working on a book about evolutionary relationships, accessing the quantum field of relating. Please join me in welcoming Patricia Albert.
Thank you and welcome everyone. I'm excited about tonight's program with Dr. Rick Hansen, who's the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, who I will introduce more fully in a few minutes. We started this New Edge series, this radio program last summer, to provide a unique opportunity for all of us, for me, the listeners, and our guests, to explore and kind of tap into and focus on, as Krista said, this new wave of consciousness, which it's not necessarily a new wave of consciousness, but it's a new wave of paying attention to the collective field and our relationships and how we come together. And just thinking, I was in New York City teaching this last weekend, being with the Evolutionary Collective, and I was on the subway at one point, and there was this girl that had this great T-shirt on from American Eagle that said, "We're in this together." It was kind of a grunge T-shirt, but I loved it. You know, it's like this sense of, that we really are in this together, and there's all kinds of, you know, with the internet and different kinds of creativity, collective creativity, and coming together and finding ways to deepen and to facilitate our ability to have more of a unity consciousness as a normal state of consciousness, which is what I'm very committed to. So tonight with Dr. Rick Hansen, we're going to explore love, sex, and intimacy, three topics that I'm sure is on the top of the list for most people. I just add money to that probably. And I want to introduce him before we start to interact. He's a neuropsychologist, which I think is a 30-year meditator. So pretty amazing combination of experience and knowledge that come together in him, in his work with people and his talks. His book's been translated into 18 different languages. He gets to speak at, you know, various universities and, you know, obviously on many shows and on the BBC. So he's quite an experienced presenter and rich in wisdom. I mean, very rich in wisdom, which I plan to be able to participate in tonight for sure. And he's an authority on self-directed neuroplasticity. So we're going to find out more about what that is and basically how to really make use of the knowledge in a way that we can make a difference in our own lives. So I want to welcome you.
Thank you.
To the show, yeah. I want to actually start out with, I'm excited to focus on the intimacy in particular, how it works and why it is actually so important to us.
That's a great question. Could you be a little more specific? Or
Well, you said, I mean, one of the things in your book that I thought was really interesting was that you said that there are scientific findings that show that intimacy is a primary driver of human development, which I think is really interesting. So it's obviously like at the core of our wiring.
Okay. Why don't we start there, all right?
Yeah.
So as the brain evolved, starting literally 600 million years ago with creatures who began to develop a nervous system, it was focused initially on avoiding harm, because that's rule number one in the wild. You know, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. And so, you know, these ancient crabs and fish and worms and insects and crocodiles and whatnot were zeroed in on, you know, avoiding harm, okay? Then after a couple 100 million years, these more sophisticated neural systems began developing that could approach or pursue rewards. In other words, rule one, avoid sticks. Rule two, approach carrots. Okay? And so those creatures, starting to move into early mammals, were more able to rev up to go get that carrot. Okay. Then, beginning with mammals, now about 200 million years ago, and birds as well, new systems developed that began to focus on attaching to loved ones. Initially, mothers and babies, and then broadening out to mothers and mates and babies, and then broadening further out into social groups, like whether it's a pack of wolves or a collection of prairie dogs or our immediate ancestors, primates, and then humans that lived in bands, in which were characterized by more and more sophisticated forms of cooperation, friendship, bonding, altruism, romance and sexuality, monogamy in some cases, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the last 200 million years, and especially the last several dozen million years, the advantages of love, broadly defined for survival, have been a primary driver of the evolution of the brain. Love is hardwired into our brain. And so, you know, that's a way, I think, to really appreciate how profoundly important intimacy is in many forms, certainly in terms of a romantic mate, but also more broadly, a sense of being included in a group you care about, the felt sense of being seen and that you matter to others, that they're tuned into you, that you exist for them in their minds, you know, and also that you get respect, that you're valued. You get what therapists like me call healthy narcissistic supplies. All the rest of that, all of that speaks to how important relationships are and, of course, how much we suffer if those needs are not met.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like on the Maslow's hierarchy, you know, that the sense of belonging would have a lot to do with that level of development, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And Maslow, I think, totally had it right. I studied him a fair amount. And, you know, level one is bare survival. That speaks to a lot,
right.
The avoiding system. And then one up from that, you know, you have sort of basic needs met, like sexuality and so forth. And so you want to approach that reward. But then layered on top of that, and then even moving into self-actualization, our needs to feel like, you know, that you're attached to those who love you. And you also have an opportunity to give love in return. Because I think that's often what is the deepest wound for people. They don't feel that there's a channel to give the love that's in their heart.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's as painful as not feeling met. I'm curious, have they done studies? Because there's obviously different levels of intimacy. You know, there can be a level of intimacy where you're literally, you know, the telepathy. It's not just empathy, but it's almost like you can feel like you're inside of the other person. Do you know what I mean? That it's not just sort of a merged state, but you're actually, you know, touching and recognizing the soul, the very core of their being. And that's, to me, when you feel met, you know, when you feel deeply, deeply seen and met, like at the most profound level. Is there something in the brain that actually is lighting up on these higher levels? Have they looked at that at all as far as like what can happen, you know, like in a sort of more extreme state?
I'll tell you a few kinds of studies. So one set of studies has to do with the neurotransmitter and hormone, oxytocin. Women have about 7 times as much oxytocin as men do. It's involved, as you probably know, and listeners know, in childbirth and the so-called letdown reflex when mothers do breastfeeding. It's also released in both men and women after orgasm. It's released when people touch skin to skin in an affectionate way. And one of the effects of it is that as oxytocin levels increase, so does the sense of trust and joining with others. So if a person is, for example, having a deeply felt sense of being loved and nurtured and known, you know, that kind of soul-to-soul bonding we sometimes can experience with others. For sure, I would. It's hard to manipulate that in an experiment, but to me it's very plausible to predict that there would be increased levels of oxytocin. A second kind of example has to do with feeling supported by others. You know, I think a lot of most relational experiences, and I speak as someone who's been married 29 and a half years, you know, I'm approaching my 30th wedding anniversary, and I'm still really in love, and I think my wife is too, and, you know, through thick and thin, raising two kids to young adulthood and, you know, all the rest of that. In that light, I do think it's important to appreciate that the most of the important relationship experiences we have are fairly mild. They're not the heights of soul-to-soul contact, which is wonderful. I'm not speaking against that. I'm just saying that, you know, most of it's about the wallpaper, you know. It's not about the orchids and the vase in the center of the room. Okay, great. And so in terms of the wallpaper, you know, aspects of a positive relationship with people, a key part of that is feeling supported and feeling like others are with you and they care. You know, they got your back. They're tight. We're on the same page. We're together on this, right? That's so important. And as someone who I've written a fair amount about relationships and particularly of all kinds, but including parental ones or mate relationships. And I think that's especially important for women as a generalization to feel that their mate is with them, okay? Well, interestingly, in studies, they have found that if people are about to get a mild but unpleasant electrical shock, you know, while they're in an MRI, if they're anticipating that shock, and then when they get that shock, these pain networks, you know, in the brain light up, okay, the same kind that light up if you, you know, bang your thumb with a hammer while you're trying to, let's say, pound a nail hanging a picture in your house or something. Well, if you let people hold the hand of someone, hold the hand of a loved one in particular, number one, their experience of pain goes down. Their subjective rating of the pain goes down fairly substantially. And also, the pain networks in the brain activate a lot less. But it has to be someone that's a loved one. Just holding the hand of an experimenter who's a nice person, but, you know, it's not the same thing as your mate, doesn't do it for you. It's about holding the hand of a loved one, which really shows that the experience of relationship support can really dampen physical pain, for example.
Wow.
As well as
that's
obviously
amazing.
Emotional.
And is that the oxytocin because you're touching and you actually feel the attention
probably,
of the person and their love?
Yeah, I don't know of anything where they've measured oxytocin. It could be that probably actually it's more diffuse. In other words, which is good news. In other words, there are more many roads to Rome. That's the good news. If there's only one road to Rome, boy, we're pretty vulnerable now. But the fact, you know, people can feel that. People can also just know it. I've come to, you know, a lot of what I have been interested in, you know, Buddhist Brain, my book, is the practical application of this stuff. Going to what you said at the beginning of this interview or dialogue we're having here, really, about self-directed neuroplasticity. It's the idea of what can you do? So for me, one of the takeaways from this whole inquiry into what scientists call the social brain and some of the really fascinating studies is to appreciate the importance for regular people in the middle of daily life, you know, stuck in traffic, wrangling with kids, dealing with something at work, whatever, you know, juggling too many emails, who knows, in the middle of all that, to open to, for a dozen seconds or two dozen or three dozen seconds, the felt sense of being cared about by others. Because if we can bring that to mind, just remembering people who've loved us or groups we belong to or friends we've had or do have today or pets are good or spiritual beings, whatever it is, that's a pathway for us to have that feeling in our body, you know, in the heart, in the face, in the body of being that we matter, that people, somebody likes us, you know, that they care about us, maybe even love and cherish us. Being able to call that experience up at will is a very important resource to have.
It's so interesting, like the way that you're speaking about it too, that it's such a sustaining, that it actually reduces the pain, the experience of pain, the pain of life, you know, much less physical pain. You know, I mean, life can be painful.
Oh, yeah.
And that someone is there supporting you can make you feel, go ahead.
Oh, you're totally right. I didn't mean to interrupt you at all. To kind of say it in a certain scientific way, the foundation of social pain and pleasure are the systems in the brain for physical pain and pleasure. The way Mother Nature builds us is kind of from like a contractor builds a house, you know, from the foundation and the basement, first floor, second floor, et cetera, on up to the penthouse suite, as it were. And the same is true in the brain. So the systems that we have for feeling, on the one hand, social pleasure, like feeling loved, feeling included, feeling approved of, you know, feeling like we're special, all that stuff, as well as social pain, you know, feeling rejected, feeling abandoned, feeling embarrassed, feeling ashamed, feeling envy, feeling jealousy, you know, feeling dissed, all that stuff. You know, those social pleasures and pains are grounded in and built on physical pleasures and pains. So that gives you kind of a two-way street. You can use social support to dial down physical pain. On the other hand, interestingly, if you give people Tylenol in an experiment, compared to a placebo, before you expose them to social rejection, you know, these are always college sophomores, of course, you know, in research studies in psychology, usually not always. But anyway, if you give people Tylenol before you embarrass them or put them down publicly, they report that it's less distressing. Isn't that wild?
Really?
Really.
That is
like a two-way street, you know. So anyway, I'm not telling people, you know, medicate yourself before you go on a job interview, but I don't know. You know, a little Advil, a little Tylenol, who knows? Anyway, don't mix them, though. That's bad. Don't mix those two. But anyway. So, yeah,
but
it's quite fascinating, isn't it? Yeah.
That feeling, too, of, you know, I mean, given that the world, you know, there seems to be, you know, a fair amount of us waking up, many people, to a more global sense of what's going on the whole planet and, you know, feeling more connected and being more immersed in, you know, kind of like the global dilemma, you know, problems, disasters, you know, the various things. So there's an opening to more pain in a way, and also more connectivity. To feel that we are in this together, then, from what you're saying, would actually be very sustaining.
That I think takes us out to a bigger picture that's really important, especially these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a world in which, on the one hand, we're much more intertwined with each other. So if there's an earthquake in Japan, it affects the economy around the world, certainly in the west coast of the United States, which is where I live. I have clients who are involved in the shipping industry, which has been totally benefited by all these disasters in Japan, because a lot of shipping that was headed for Japan has to come here instead. You know, stuff like that, crazy stuff.
Right.
And on the other hand, although most of the things that affect us, of course, are for the worse, and also we're dealing in a world where we've got shrinking resources. You know, we're running out of water worldwide. Population is continuing to grow. The planet is heating up. And there's more and more access to incredibly lethal weapons. You know, in that larger context, you know, we do have two wolves in the heart. You know, we evolved a wonderful wolf of love, as it were, that you and I have spoken of so far, but we also, frankly, evolved the capacity and, in many people, and you know, in all of us to varying degrees, the inclination to fear and attack, quote-unquote, them. You know, that's the wolf of hate, as it were. And that kind of made sense as a strategy to pass on genes, you know, in the Serengeti as we were evolving. But these days, where, you know, if we fear and attack them, next thing we know we're in a nuclear war, or we've got people flying airplanes into buildings and killing 3,000 people in one day. You know, we're going to be approaching the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 in about 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, in that larger context, I think it's very important for people to have a growing capacity to expand the circle of us to include the whole wide world. That doesn't mean rolling over. I mean, it's like you can have a circle of us in a workplace setting or in a family or in a larger social group inside of which you deal with issues, right, and you deal with them directly. You can have a marriage or a relationship in which there's an us that has two people in it, and you can really assert yourself, but you do so inside a frame of usness, as it were, and I think that's the key. You know, the brain, basically, as soon as we make a distinction between us and them, it starts looking for ways to be better than them, and, you know, it gets very sensitized to any form of apparent mistreatment. And then, You know, as soon as there's any kind of sense of threat, wham, the wolf of hate gets up and starts looking for someone to bite.
How do we overcome that tendency? You know, what are some practical things that you feel are useful?
That's a great question. I think one is to shore up your own personal sense of strength, because if you feel stronger inside, you're going to feel less threatened, and you're going to also have more patience and be able to give yourself a gift of time, basically, whereby you can, you know, see more clearly what in the world is really going on here. You know, many apparent threats turn out to be just paper tigers. That's one. You know, shoring up and developing your internal sense of strength, I think that's very important for everybody. I have to say, as a feminist kind of person, I think it's particularly important for women, you know, who often have experiences of feeling small or weak or pushed on because they were, you know. So developing that sense of strength, I think, is very important. A second thing is to have more empathy for other people. Not that we approve of them or we agree with them or we waive our rights, but as we have more empathy for them, as we understand more deeply what in the world is motivating this person to do this to me right now, that gives us lots and lots of valuable information. You know, for one, we can start seeing that maybe some of what's happening there is just a kind of passing reaction. Unfortunately, we're in the way of their bad day, but truly, we're just a bit player in their drama. It's not so much that they're targeting us. Yes, it's painful. Yes, it's to be avoided or dealt with, but it's not so personal as we think it is. You know, empathy can help us in that way. Empathy can also help us understand the ways that maybe inadvertently we've triggered that other person. You know, our intent was innocent or neutral, but our impact on them was negative, and so we can then address it, you know, in more skillful ways so it doesn't happen again. You know, and also empathy can help us understand what the deeper needs or wants are in the other person so we can address them, and so that person then, so we can potentially address them, so that the other person then can feel less aggressive and threatened, and so they won't pose so much of a threat for us. That's the second thing, I think, empathy. A third thing is to get a grip on, you know, the way we do tend to have paper tiger paranoia. The default setting of the brain is what's called the negativity bias. It is to be kind of threat reactive and mildly paranoid. Our ancestors that were all super confident, joie de vivre, mellow, happy-go-lucky, you know, rose-colored lenses, chomp, they got eaten, right? The ones that survived were anxious and irritable. and we're their great-grandchildren on top of the food chain with nuclear weapons. So, you know, we tend to the generic tendency, which then gets intensified by temperament. Some people are more anxious than others, and then also can be intensified by life experiences, you know, like a rocky childhood or tough in the last 10 years, and then intensified by culture and politics, because it's always a great way to get the populace to kind of put up with the authoritarian rulers, as it were, to make them feel fear. So, you know, the generic tendency is to typically overestimate threats, underestimate opportunities, and underestimate resources for dealing with both threats and, fulfilling opportunities. And so if you know your tendency, you know, if you know you tend to overestimate the threat and you tend to underestimate your own strengths or the resources around you, or you tend to underestimate your opportunities, you know, you can put in a correction factor. So that would be my third suggestion. Really investigate how you're seeing things, what your automatic assumptions are. You know, in psychological language, what are the appraisals you routinely make of a situation? Like, how do you interpret an event? Like, I walked home, you know, before this call, and I just had a few minutes to connect with my wife before doing this with you at 6 o'clock, you know, West Coast time. And my wife said that, you know, she was upset about something. And, you know, I had that sinking feeling in my stomach. Oh, God, it's me. What did I do? You know, here I am, the husband, running through my mental checklist. What did I do wrong? What did I say? Did anything? Was I supposed to bring home the milk? And I blew it, you know, tick, 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 tick. And I came up, you know, nothing on my checklist. And, you know, she's a good wife. She's smart and a good person. And she, within seconds, 10, 20 seconds, she said, you know, it's not about you. Don't worry. And I was like, whoosh, what a relief, you know. But for that 5 to 10 seconds, just autopilot, yeah, those reactions arose, as they naturally do. And I'm a guy who's practiced pretty deeply for a long time. If they're arising in my mind, you know what I mean? They ought to be arising in the minds of other people. So, you know, it's paying attention to that tendency to appraise situations. as more threatening, et cetera, than they maybe actually are. Okay, and then to complete my kind of quickies here, and there's a lot more to
it. Yeah, no, this
is
good. Yeah, there's a lot more in the book about it.
Because it's so deep, I actually have chapters on this stuff, you know, how to really do it. But another one is to really routinely calm the body. For example, routinely practice relaxation. There are multiple wings of the nervous system to simplify. One wing cranks us up. That's the sympathetic nervous system, the stress response, fight or flight wing. It's balanced like on a seesaw. So when one wing goes up, it pushes the other wing down by a wing that's called the parasympathetic nervous system. It's actually the original wing of the nervous system. It's this rest and digest, centering, calming, soothing wing. Well, practice routinely activating that more relaxing, soothing, centering wing. A lot of ways to do it, lying on the floor at the end of a yoga class, or long exhalations, multiple long exhalations, because the parasympathetic wing handles exhaling, warming your hands stimulates parasympathetic activation, relaxing the tongue does, because rest and digest begins in the mouth if you digest, right? Notice you're all right now. In other words, just have a moment that you're basically all right now. Now, occasionally you're not. All right. When you're not, you're not. But most of the time, most people, certainly in, you know, the developed world, are basically all right now. And if you just register that in your body, you can feel your body just kind of opening and softening because you know you're all right now. You don't need to be so braced, so guarded and so vigilant and so anxious, which just breeds paper tiger paranoia. Because, to wrap on this point, I promise, the brain gets sensitized by stress. That means in a vicious cycle, if you're feeling anxious today, that makes you a little bit more vulnerable to anxiety tomorrow, which makes you even more anxious the day after tomorrow. See how that works? So that's a great strategy for passing on gene copies in the wild. It's a terrible strategy for quality of life and long-term health. You know, when our ancestors died by their 30th birthday, typically, the short-term benefits of stress reactivity and threat reactivity and paper tiger paranoia and the negativity bias and all that stuff, the short-term benefits outweighed the long-term cost. But these days, when people want to live well into middle age and beyond, my dad's 92. He's doing great. He's got a new lady friend, and she's a young whippersnapper to him. She's in her early 80s. They're happy, you know? He's still got some juice, some sap flowing through those veins. And, 92 is the new 72, whatever. And so, anyway, when you want to live long and well, again, it's important to be to try to downregulate stress, to turn the dial down, you know, whenever you can. And one way to do that is to notice in your body, in truth, multiple times a day, you're actually basically all right now.
And this is when you're, you know, in the book and in your expertise. So this is the self-directed neuroplasticity, you know, like teaching the pathways in your brain to go in a different direction.
Yeah, these would be multiple.
Yeah,
these would be multiple examples of, in effect, taking charge of your own brain. Now, some of these examples are, I want to be the first to say, are old wine in new bottles. In other words, people have known for a long time, well before brain scans. You know, I'm trained in several contemplative traditions, especially Buddhist. And, you know, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha achieved, I believe, enlightenment. I think a lot of people would agree, as well as brought a lot of other people very far along the path, including all the way, in many cases, to its end, in terms of awakening. And they did it without knowing anything about an MRI. So I think it's important to be kind of humble about what brain science is really offering. To me, where it really adds value is in motivating people to really appreciate that everything I've said to you is grounded in science and will make a positive change in the brain. Like, that's motivating. Additionally, it really does help from time to time to do, in effect, with reverse engineering. In other words, if you can identify the neural substrates, in other words, what's going on in the brain when good stuff is going on in the mind? In other words, when people are having good thoughts or feeling good feelings or opening up to spiritual realization or grounding in love, you know, opening their heart, becoming more resilient, et cetera, et cetera. When people are having these positive psychological states, okay, what in the world is going on in the brain at the same time? And until very recently, nobody knew the answer to that question. And, you know, 20 years ago, people knew more about the dark side of the moon, probably, than they did about the mapping between the mind and the brain. But now, as neuroscience has basically doubled in its knowledge base, in just the last 20 years, people know twice as much today, essentially, than they did in 1990. You know, wow. All right. What's increasingly clear is how to do that reverse engineering. It's increasingly clear what's actually going on in the brain when your mind is in a really good place. And that, then, gives us the power to stimulate those key neural substrates, to stimulate those key neural circuits that underpin, you know, really positive states of mind. And interestingly, and this is where the fancy phrase experience-dependent neuroplasticity comes in, as you stimulate these, you know, neural circuits of good mind states, as you stimulate them, you strengthen them. Because in the famous saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together, right? So if you, for better or worse, you know what I mean? If you rest your mind and therefore your brain routinely on negative stuff like grumbling complaints about others or, you know, lashing self-criticism or exaggerated fears of the world, etc., your brain will gradually take the shape because those neurons are going to start wiring together based on how they've been firing together. Your brain will gradually take the shape of depressed mood, anxiety, you know, more sensitivity to stress, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, if you rest your mind and therefore your brain on factually based positive themes, like the basic good things of daily life that you're grateful for, you know, the good qualities in your own self, you know, your own good qualities of heart, the little accomplishments and sometimes big ones of everyday life, you know, the people around you who are doing nice things for you, maybe if it's real for you, your sense of the divine in the largest sense. You know, as you do that, your brain takes a different shape because you've got different, you know, firing patterns and therefore different wiring patterns. And now you're wiring resources like self-confidence, self-worth, a positive mood, greater resilience, greater grit and capacity to deal with the tough things in life because there are tough things in life. There are real tigers out there, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you are basically taking your brain into a better place. And what I find very exciting, what my book's about and what we're talking about here, is the idea that really regular people in regular daily life can do little things every day that gradually will change their brain for the better over time.
Wonderful. Yes, it's and you have so many different examples and just ideas and ways in which people can find that.
Yeah, thank you.
So, yeah, it's really, it's very rich in that. I want to ask a question, like with, obviously, we, you know, we can do practices on our own, and you can get into positive or negative sort of looping states with other people as well.
Yeah.
You know, and you were saying how important the support is. Can you say anything about like the like what happens like when you're mirroring each other in a positive way? Do you know what I mean? When you're, you know, looking into each other's eyes and there's, you know, a certain amount of, you know, connection and bliss being shared. You know, what what does that do?
Well, that's where people do talk about mirroring and mirror neurons. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a, you know, I don't know, I'll make a kind of seemingly technical point that has really big implications in regular life. The technical point is that mirror, like, for example, to make it concrete, if I were to ask you, let's say, and all of, let's suppose we were doing this video, okay, so you could see me. And if I were to ask you and your listeners to reach out for an imaginary cup, so imagine doing that, and you could actually do this at home if you want. So you reach out for an imaginary cup, bring it to your lips, and then set it down. All right, so you did that. And then if you were to watch me do the same thing, I'm reaching out now for an imaginary cup, bringing it to my mouth and then setting it down. A fraction of the same neurons that lit up in your sensory motor circuits when you reached for the cup also light up when you see me reaching for the cup, which gives you a visceral sense from the inside out of a kind of semblance or echo or resonance in your own body of what it would be like to be me reaching for that cup. And that's a great way for animals, because animals can do this, to read kind of inside their own body the intentions of others, predators, prey, and members of their own social species. All right? So that's what mirror neurons do. The thing is, mirror neurons basically, and it's even debatable whether any have actually been found in the human brain, but let's assume for the moment that there are mirror-like networks, certainly, in the human brain. What they do is they mirror actions. That's all they do. They just mirror actions. And, yeah, it's important to tune into the actions of others, but if you're just sitting there with your sweetie, gazing into his or her eyes, you know, just being present there, talking a little bit, touching lightly, you know, you're not particularly mirroring his or her actions. What is more going on is that you are, in effect, empathy is simulating. You know, if we simulate the actions of others inside our own mind, but we also simulate the emotions of others inside our own mind, and we simulate the states of mind of others inside our own mind. And these two latter aspects of empathy, in other words, resonating with or simulating, in effect, the emotions of others and also the mind states of others, mind broadly defined, those are handled by very different circuits than mirror-like networks. Simulating the emotions of others is really handled by a part of the brain called the insula, which is also involved in tuning into yourself. So, wonderfully, if you tune into yourself more and more, you will literally increase the thickness of your own brain in the region of the insula, which, in turn, will make you more empathic and capable of tuning into the emotions of others. It's like building a muscle, you know. As you work out, the muscle gets bigger, and as the muscle gets bigger, it has more functional capacity. It can do more good things for you and other people. In the case here of the insula.
Can I ask a question? Is that the
totally.
Part of the brain then that that where like intuition is developed as well, like where you can actually just intuit
what's going on with
like
others?
That, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Telepathy,
I think,
intuition, is it like in that domain?
I think sometimes we intuit the feelings of others, but this empathic intuition, and again, whatever is involved in that, that's kind of more grounded in the meat, if you will, rather than in, who knows, subtle energies, stuff like
right,
that.
Okay.
You know? But if we just kind of, I'm cool with that stuff. I think, yeah, just, you know. But if we just kind of stay grounded so far with what's known in a very young science, which is neuroscience certainly, I would say it's probably a little more complicated than that. In other words, part of what we're doing when we're tuning into others and we just have this intuition is we are picking up subtle signals about their body posture, their gestures, you know, facial expressions that we're kind of mirroring with our own facial expressions. So some of that is accomplished by these mirror network type systems, these mirror networks. Okay, good. Also, we are tuning into their emotions, you know, and in particular, talking about the third system, we're tuning into their mind states, which is more grounded in the prefrontal cortex, the part just behind the forehead. And that part of the that capacity is what's called theory of mind. If there are therapists on this call, or you too, Patricia, you're probably familiar with that term, theory of mind. It's the idea that when we start getting around age 4, maybe age 3-ish, definitely by age 4, we start forming more of a notion of what other people are thinking and so forth. So, and part of what happens there is we do kind of hypothesis testing. We sort of imagine, almost in the back of our mind, kind of intuitively, what could they be thinking? What would I be feeling? And then we check into our body. You know, that's where we go more into the body, into the mirror neurons, let's say. And we go, would that ring true? Yeah, it would ring true. And then it just kind of comes to us as an intuition. But I think that all these systems are involved. But one way you can help these systems, I could tell you a couple of things that really help deep intuition into our partners. One is to really open up into a lot of self-awareness. So you're open to the signals that are coming to you from inside your own being, whether they're bubbling up in your body or more in your emotions or just in your kind of psychological-ness about the other person. That's important. Another one, I think of it myself when I'm really tuning into people. I'm a therapist, you know, I'm a psychologist. I do it all day long. And I think as a guy, I'm pretty good at it. You know, maybe just pretty good at it, pure and simple. Part of it for me is I feel like I cast loose of the familiar moorings of my own worldview, my own notion. And I just enter the deep ocean of the other person's beingness. And to do that, paradoxically, you need a strong sense of self. I don't mean more precisely, you need a strong sense of personhood, not ego. Your own being, you know, distinct from the being of the other person. Because studies have shown, actually, that people who tend to have really poor boundaries, porous boundaries that tend to, you know, merge with others or have this kind of symbiosis with others, it's hard for them to sustain empathy because they get flooded by the other person. So to really cast loose of your own moorings, you have to have some confidence, you know, that you can swim back again if you need to. And but for me, that, you know, based on that confidence, that's also a very useful way to just open out into the world of the other person. And then I think the last one that really promotes intuition into other people is a gentle process of inquiry that has an active and investigative quality. It's not that you're trying to play therapist on your loved ones or your kid or your parents or your friend, whatever. But you're curious. You're investigating. You may not be saying a word. A lot of this investigating or curiosity is occurring inside your own mind. A lot of it's nonverbal. You're just kind of feeling your way into this other person, but you're trying on different possibilities based on what you know about them, their history, their Enneagram point, whatever, you know, their background, what's happened to them that day, where they are in their monthly cycle, whatever. You know, you're tuning into them and just imagining different possibilities in an active kind of way. Sometimes we think of empathy. Empathy has two aspects. One is very receptive, but another part is more active, you know, where we're inquiring, largely inside our own mind, into what could be going on inside the other person.
Yeah, I think I agree with, you know, like that sense of, like, penetration, you know, that there's a curiosity that actually wants to penetrate into the reality of the other. Because a lot of times people don't even reach across the bridge.
Yeah, you have to. That's another really true.
All that interested.
I know it's actually
amazing.
Very poignant. You have to give attention, and the word there is give. It's in a sense a gift. And how often do listeners feel like they're on the receiving end of 10 minutes straight of sustained interest and attention from someone who's significant? Flip the other way.
Yeah.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
600 seconds.
Yeah.
10 minutes. How often do we give others that sustained, you know, we just give our mind over to them. That's part of what empathy is, too. We just give our mind over to them. But again, you've got to have a strong sense of personhood to be willing to give your mind over to somebody. But 10 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, what's you want to hear my...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just, well... I'm liking this, so I'm being a little playful. But I'll tell you, you want to hear my prescription to cut the divorce rate in half?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, it's a little controversial, you know. Ready? Here we go. 3 questions in a row every day and sex twice a week.
Any 3 questions?
Yeah, about the other person, about their inner world. So obviously, to qualify this, because I'm being deliberately a little provocative, you know, there's a huge, long, long history of, you know, of typically men controlling women around sex. You know, I think that's abhorrent. It's got to feel comfortable. There's got to be teamwork. There's got to be communication, blah, blah, blah. But I will say this. I've known a lot of couples where the foundation was there. You know, there was a sense of friendship, there was a sense of teamwork, there was not, you know, gross mistreatment of each other, and still, they didn't make it important to connect in that way. And the other side of it is, boy, oh boy, you think of all the relationships where empathy is what drew them together, but now, a year later, or 10 or 30 years later, they are like living separate lives, and they really don't sit down on a daily basis and enter into the mind of each other and take the 10 minutes, or the even 20 minutes, God help us, of sustaining an interest in the other person. not driven by some prosecutorial agenda or some task agenda, like, or persuasion agenda, but truly three questions in a row. You know, how was your day today? You know, okay, that's one. How did it feel when? All right, now we're getting deeper. Three, what did you really want in that situation? What would have made it better for you? Now we've got our three questions out on the table, and that's a different kind of conversation than many people have. And I think people in general really appreciate that. I think, to generalize grossly, I think my experience, heterosexual couples, probably lesbian couples too, women really appreciate that. But I'd have to say for many men, you know, in long-term relationships, they feel like they're kind of a means to their partner's ends, you know, and they don't really have that sense of, you know, that they really matter, you know, to their partner.
What's interesting, it's like, I really appreciate your, because you have a very practical approach that I think really makes sense to people in a very, you know, realistic way. I've been sort of working on the sort of more extreme end of this level of intimacy and mutuality, so that it's, you know, that quality of really being very autonomous, you know, really developing the true autonomy, you know, focusing on that in a very strong way, and then really becoming incredibly interested and curious and engaging with another, not, like you said, with an agenda, but in a kind of openness, which, to me, I call it the optimizing force. There's something that when you're not trying to make something happen and you're really interested and you're really committed and you're engaged, there's something that starts to take over in between the two that is so profound, whether it's in a creative, you know, if two people are being creative together or they're making love or they're talking, you know, it's like something in the in-between, like David Bohm, you know, the scientist, would talk about, can profoundly happen. And human beings don't realize that they have this wild capacity. It's like between human beings, we can create babies, and we can also create, like, higher and higher levels of the most amazing creativity and connection and possibilities if we only, like you said, you know, took the time to focus and get out of the way long enough, you know, have some meditative capacity and really see what's possible, because it's a great gift, and we don't use the gift.
Oh, I totally agree with you, and I think, you know, I think about the metaphor of a kite. Paradoxically, if you, a kite cannot soar if it's attached to the ground. If you let go of the string of a kite, it'll fall, it'll drop. So I think it's important to ground the loftiest possible states of love and intimacy and profundity in a real way. Like, at the most basic level, how much time are you spending together? You know, as a couples therapist, I'll have people come in, and they'll say, gee, we've really drifted apart. And I'll say, okay, how much time every day do you spend together just as friends, you know, let alone lovers, because the last time they made love was 6 months ago or whatever, or 6 weeks ago often. And they'll say, well, no time or nothing. I'm too tired, or we go to bed and, you know, she reads and I fall asleep, or she reads and I watch TV with my headphones on or something like that. All right, a million miles away. Okay, great. So then I say, well, can you spend more time together? We make a plan. And then interestingly, very often couples will come in week after week paying me significant amounts of money, you know, as a psychologist in a upper middle class community. And, you know, they will not make time for each other. There's always some reason, right?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But that said, one other thing that I've seen really makes a difference is finding fondness for other people. You know, I think at any moment there's a range of what's authentically possible between us and other people. And we don't want to be inauthentic, you know. But there's a range, right? And that range moves up or down, depending, and it widens and contracts, depending on what's happened in the last 10 minutes and 10 days and 10 years. Okay. But on any given moment, there's a range of what's authentically possible. And very, very, very often, people could reach down inside and find things that are not top of mind, let's say, for their partner, but would be authentic. they do love their partner, or they are fond of their partner, or there are things in their partner that they truly cherish. And if they would use a little will, they could reach down and really center in and sustain their own internal experience of cherishing their partner, or this other person, let's say, need not be a partner, mm-hmm. and being fond of them, finding things to like about that other person. You know, we often think it's interesting that, you know, we realize that if we want to make, you know, if we want to have good stuff in life, you know, good career, good parenting, good golf game, good business, good vacation, what have you, we have to plan for it and we have to work at it. But then when it comes to love, people often think, yeah, I just want to roll out of bed and fall into deep bliss, right, with my partners here. And well, no, I mean, yeah, there's a part of it. There's a magic that just comes along and grabs you, and oh my God. But so much of it, especially over the longer haul, is truly is about a willed action where you create intentions and you do things deliberately. People sometimes think that makes it less loving. I say it makes it twice loving, because what you find when you reach down that's authentic is an authentic love, and it was loving to make the effort to reach down inside yourself, pull it up, and express it. So it's twice loving in my view.
Absolutely. So I have a question. What's at the edge of your work at this point, you know, for you?
You mean at a personal level or with people in general?
Yeah, kind of personally and professionally, yeah. Like what's kind of...
Yeah, two things.
You. Yeah.
They overlap in a lot of ways. At a more professional level, I'm really interested in helping the world change significantly, you know, not to be grandiose, but just doing my bit in my little pond, you know, for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And a thing I'm really zeroed in on is this business of people generically, you know, by default in the brain, not abiding in the good. In other words, not turning mm-hmm. to the real good that's in themselves and within others around them and between them and others and in the larger world, and that's possible. The good that exists and is possible, turning to it and deliberately, repeatedly internalizing it and opening up to it and giving oneself over to it and having faith in the good. And I think that is a key piece of helping this world become a gooder place, you know, a better place. So that's one thing that really interests
wonderful.
Me. Yeah, and I'm writing more about it, this business of taking in the good, which is one chapter in my book, but I'm going to write a book about it, I think. And I do lectures on that. If people want, by the way, they can go to my website where there's a ton of free material, including slide sets, PowerPoint slide sets from many workshops I've done for therapists on taking in the good, cultivating wholesome qualities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you give me your website address?
Oh, thank you. Buddhasbrain.com.
Yeah.
That'll take you right there, Buddhasbrain.com. The other thing, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll be succinct here.
Yeah.
Personally, I find myself in my own daily experiences, and especially in my own meditative practice, and people can, you know, use this as they like, is more and more I find myself just kind of opening out into, you know, the present moment, grounded in the body, letting go of everything else. And I find that practice, you know, of opening into the present moment, grounded in the body, you know, the felt sense of the body, so you're not airy-fairy, losing it, getting spacey, abiding as the body, letting go of everything else, is a very powerful way to feel less egoic, less selfish, and less self-centered. It's a very powerful way to experience directly that you actually are all right now. Now it's all right, you know. It was the past that was a bummer, and it's the future we're worried about. But right now is basically all right. So when you're in now, you feel it in your body. And you go, you know, it's not like you're believing it because Eckhart Tolle told you so, you know, who I think is a great teacher, to be sure. But it's that you feel it. Like, I'm fine. Like, hey, it's all right now. And it takes you into a more of a continuous experience of connectedness with the whole wide world, the larger network that we all arise and abide in. Because when you are more present in now, you can feel the ways in which the fleeting sensations, the moves of your body, the fleeting sounds you hear, the sights you have, the thoughts moving through your mind, are arising kind of interdependently with this wider world. You know, they arise based on, in the moment, little sounds outside your house or, you know, little issues you're dealing with or what have you. You feel more connected, more oneness, and so forth. But it's based on something that feels very real rather than being conceptual. In other words, it comes directly.
Right, totally.
So, yeah, and so that, and the two overlap because that practice takes you more into the present good, if you will, that's here, because when you do that, you know, the brain defaults. This is some of my recent work. The default state of the brain, when it's not disturbed, including chemically, is a pretty good place of calm, contentment, and caring, you know, in terms of those three systems, avoiding, approaching, and attaching. You know, we default to calm in terms of the avoiding system. The home base of the brain in terms of the approaching system is contentment, mild well-being. And then the home base of the brain in terms of the attaching system is caring, generally speaking. So when you're opening out into the present without any craving, you know, using the Buddhist term there, you're not resisting anything, nor are you grasping after anything. You're just all right here and now. You know, you're enjoying what's enjoyable. You're allowing what's not enjoyable, but you're not getting worked up about it, you know. When you do that, that takes you, that helps your brain default to that good state, so there's more of that present good. You have more of a sense that the world's okay, it's, you know, you're, and that takes you into a sense of good. And when you come out of this practice, you're a lot less obnoxious with your wife.
That's true.
or your kids, or the people that
totally
are, you know, drive cutting you off on the freeway. So there you go.
So I want to thank you. We are about to run out of time. I totally want to thank you, and I really highly want to recommend that people read The Buddha's Brain. There's so much, you know, there's background information, but like in your conversation tonight, you know, it's like it's very focused on, you know, what you can do and the perspectives to take that will actually make a difference in your life. And I, you know, appreciate that you have that gift and that commitment, you know, to actually have it be real for people, because I respect
that.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's in the trenches. That's what really matters, you know. Who knows what I'll be doing in my 70s or 80s against my wife's protests, you know, going into the monastery. But meanwhile, hey, it's the real world. That's where we need to live.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, of course, the monastery is the real world, too, as they would be the first to tell you.
Yeah, that's true. I do want to let people know that our next show, just to let people know, on May 10th, John Renish is going to be coming. He's a futurist and an author of and an editor of 12 books, and his new book is about the great growing up of humanity. So from collective adolescence to adulthood, which you know, I'm sure that there's a way that we can probably all find our unconsciously, sort of individually and collectively acting like teenagers in the world, and that there's a certain maturity, you know, that you're speaking to tonight, you know, that we're all, I think, working on maturing in a way that we can actually then, you know, have humanity, you know, maybe resolve some of the issues and the things that we're dealing with. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I had a teacher actually one time say that maturity was more important than getting what you want, which didn't really ring true for me at that moment. I think I was being very demanding and bratty. But basically, it's very, very true. Absolutely. It's like having the maturity and the groundedness and the perspective of wholeness is enormously gratifying. So, okay, so I want to thank you again, and thank everyone for being here tonight, and we will see you next time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for participating in this transformational interaction. We encourage you to go to our website, www.evolutionarycollective.com, for more information on our ongoing radio shows, live events, and intensives. You can download past programs there and share them with others. Until next time.